This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We've got our look at whether Ohio is still a bellwether state in presidential elections and how candidates for president will approach this state in 2020. Political analysts appear to be split on the issue of whether it's still a bellwether state if you read think pieces by national outlets. But what do local and state political leaders and thinkers have to say about it? The Republican panel will join us at the bottom of the hour for their perspective. But first up, we've got the Democrats. And joining us now, our Ohio Democratic Party Chairman, David Pepper. Welcome, Chairman Pepper.
Thanks. Great to be back.
We have Democracy for America Chief Executive and media political commentator, Yvette Simpson. Hi, Yvette.
Thanks, Scott. Glad to be here, Michael.
Joining us via Skype is co-host of the podcast Pantsuit Politics and co-author of the I Think You're Wrong, But I'm Listening Anyway book, Sarah Stewart Holland. Sarah, thanks for being back with us.
Thanks for having me.
And we're also joined by Miami University Assistant Professor of Political Science, Dr. Rachel Bloom. She's the author of the upcoming book, Party Takeover. Dr. Bloom, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Because of the number of guests that we have today, we're not going to be able to take any phone calls, but if you want to tweet at us, hit us up at 917-WVXU. Find us on Facebook. You can leave some comments there or email talk@WVXU.org. Okay, so the next debate for the Democratic presidential nomination is right here in Ohio. The candidates will be at Otterbein in less than a couple of weeks. So let's just start with that. David, I want to start with you. What do Ohio voters in particular want to hear from these 12 candidates we're going to see?
So I think, first of all, thank you for having me. I think that one reason, and I obviously pushed very hard and advocated hard to have the debate in Ohio, I think, you know, within a not very long distance of Otterbein are many of the issues that matter to Americans that also matter to Ohioans. I think Otterbein's not far from Dayton, so I think you are going to hear a lot about gun violence and what Democratic candidates want to do about that. We also aren't too far when we're in Otterbein from Lordstown and Youngstown, and we are seeing in the news, a manufacturing recession beginning, and you're seeing it in Ohio with the layoffs at GM Lordstown and a president who said those didn't matter. And of course, Ohio is a state that's being hurt a lot by the trade policies that are really costing dairy farms and soybean farms, many going into bankruptcy, many struggling. So I think having a debate in Ohio, and this is the role that Ohio often plays, we have all the things that are going on in the country right here in the state. So I think a lot of the biggest issues that people care about are going to be talked about and will be very relevant to the folks who are going to be at the debate as well as the folks who are watching in Ohio and beyond. No doubt, you know, there'll also be discussion of the last couple of days of craziness out of Washington. But my hope is we are able to get to those types of issues, which are the types of issues that really, that Ohio voters are thinking about as they vote next year.
Well, we're certainly going to be talking about the evolving story out of Washington, right, D.C. here coming up in just a moment. And I'll bring in the panel here with us for their perspective on that very question in just a moment. But David, when we see these candidates take the stage here in Ohio, there's mm-hmm. going to be about 12 of them, it looks like. We are seeing some divisions among these candidates, healthcare, guns, tax policies, where you see the most distinct policy differences that separate them. It suggests that the left flank and maybe the more traditionally moderate flank of the party are clashing a little bit on stage, as you see from cycle to cycle.
Right.
Does that debate within this debate hurt the party?
No, I mean, I think it's a robust, healthy primary. The thing that I always try and remind people, and this is what I wish candidates would do on the debate stage, whether it's healthcare or climate change or gun violence, whatever the disagreements among those candidates happen to be, each of them is standing in a place where the vast majority of Americans agree versus the ultimate opponent, Donald Trump. They have different views on how to expand and build on the Affordable Care Act. Some go further than others. Trump wants to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. That's the extreme position. Each one of them wants to do something more on gun violence. Donald Trump doesn't want to do anything. That's the position that most Americans disagree with. And on climate change, all of our candidates are eager to do something. Now, their plans are different. But Donald Trump doesn't believe in climate change. And that, again, is like a 20% position. So I think our candidates need to, and the smart candidate will say, okay, folks, all 12 of us have a different view on these things. But all of us stand with the mainstream of America because we want to do X, Y, and Z on health care, gun violence, or climate change. It's Donald Trump and Republicans that are the extremists. because they don't want to do anything on any of these things, except, for example, getting rid of the Affordable Care Act, which is a deeply unpopular position.
Yvette Simpson is now the chief executive of Democracy for America, and you hear her here on NPR's Here and Now quite frequently these days. We see her on ABC News as well. So you've also, prior to becoming a commentator within the media, you've run a few races in Ohio.
Yeah,
so you've,
one or two.
You're a former city council member here in Cincinnati, and you've talked to voters before.
Yeah.
You know how to talk to voters.
Absolutely.
And to address what they want to hear from you. What do you think when we see these candidates, these 12 candidates in the Democratic primary taking the stage in a couple of weeks here in Ohio, what are voters going to want to hear?
You know, I think I've said it, you know, multiple times, really, how are you going to change my life? I think, you know, the policies, this and that, the intricacies, I think people want to know that their lives are going to change, particularly when we talk about non-traditional, unlikely, not regular voters, right? And I think that's the real key. It's going to take all of us. I will back out and say it's going to take all of us. It's going to take rural voters. It's going to take progressive voters. It's going to take moderate voters. But really, the energy of the party and the way that we win this thing decisively is getting voters who don't traditionally vote. That's how we won when Barack Obama was running back in 2008. And those folks want to know that you care about me and my issues and you're actually going to do something, right? And I think the prevailing wisdom is that those folks are just naturally going to be motivated by hatred for Trump. Maybe some of them will. But the rest of them are going to say, government's never worked for me, so why do I care? And they probably won't show up. So I hope that these, and I think David's right, you've got a diversity of voters in Ohio, black, brown people, you've got urban centers, you've got rural voters, all here in middle America is what I call it. Speak to those issues and talk about how you're actually going to change people's lives.
So how does that debate within the debate then play out in that respect? You know, there are people who are wondering, how is this going to change my life when you see this moderate versus liberal flank of the party going up against each other?
You know, clearly I represent the progressive wing. And I think that looks like acknowledging the fact that this is a tough time for most Americans. You know, the reality is that climate change is not something that we can wait on. We see the Amazon on fire. We see the hottest temperatures on record. We need to do something now. Right. And the time for playing is gone. People are dying under the weight of our healthcare system right now. People are trying to get to Canada to get insulin. People can't afford healthcare in this country. We need something right now. And so clearly the progressive wing of the party wants change right now. And I think that's possible. I think what Trump and the Republicans have shown is if you want something bad enough, you can get it. They're fighting for all the wrong things and they're using all the wrong measures. Why can't the good guys fight hard for the things that matter to most Americans?
We are going to hear the Republican perspective in the back half of the show. We'll be joined by a Republican panel and another political science professor. And that will be coming up at the bottom of the hour. Let's bring in Sarah Stewart Holland. She's on the phone with us. She's the co-host of Pantsuit Politics podcast and the author of I Think You're Wrong, But I'm Listening. Sarah, you've been listening to our conversation here as well, and I'm wondering what your message is to Ohio voters about what the issues are that they should probably be paying attention to in this Democratic primary debate.
Well, I think as we see some of that internal debate among the candidates, the more progressive wing, the more moderate wing, I think I have a little bit different perspective than the other panelists, because what we hear from our listeners is there is concern about policy issues. There is concern about pocketbook issues. But if you really want to motivate people to turn out, so many voters are listening for your story. So many voters are listening for how you talk to them. Are you talking down to them? Are you listening to their concerns? Are you trusting them with their vote? Are you trusting them with their own perspective? So much of these decisions are emotional. And I think that listening to the debate, you know, body language, all these different things come into play. And so as we move forward with this other debate, there's that undercurrent underneath these pocketbook issues, under these everyday issues about which candidate is really connecting with people.
Each of our partisan panels will be joined by a political science professor from the area. And the Democrats today are joined by Miami University Assistant Professor of Political Science, Dr. Rachel Bloom. Rachel, you're listening to the comments here. I'm wondering what you're just seeing from an academic perspective and just an observer of politics. How do you think these candidates and their messages, which vary, will play out in the Buckeye State this year?
Well, it depends what constituency we're talking about, because there's a little bit that has to intervene before we can get to how Ohio voters would cast their ballots in a primary or what would happen in general elections. So we need to think about Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, And they have slightly different demographic constituencies than Ohio does. So Iowa has a lot of white progressive voters. South Carolina's main constituency is female, white. Maybe 2% of their Democratic primary voters are between the ages of 18 and 24. So a candidate has to win at least Iowa or get second in Iowa and win New Hampshire for them to be the front runner. And in the past, we know a lot of that's been decided by party insiders, at least until the Republicans in 2016. So part of the question is, who needs to be persuaded by these candidates in order for one of them to get the nomination?
So really, even though this debate is taking place in Ohio in less than a couple of weeks, it's really the eyeballs coming from Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina that are going to be more important?
To a certain extent, yes. Or if you want to step back a little bit more, people who are what we would consider in political science party insiders, which no one really wants to be called an insider, but that would be like my co-panelists, people who have been involved in state or local politics, national politics, have an audience. Typically, the person that party insiders rally behind prior to Iowa is the person who gets the nomination. That may not play out. It didn't play out in 2016, so we might see something different. But the debates are, we need to take them with a grain of salt in terms of the actual outcome.
I want to get both of your perspectives on that as well, because it's an interesting point that Rachel has raised there. The Democratic candidates will be debating in Ohio, David, in just a couple of weeks. But the primary elections don't start until January, and then Ohio's votes are well after some of those key early states, and the field will be whittled down. So what is the message to Ohio voters if they get excited about a candidate who's ultimately eliminated by their peers in other states?
I actually think that our primary will ultimately be very important. We are a mid-March primary, and early voting in Ohio starts a month before that. So on Super Tuesday, Ohioans are already voting. So I don't think everyone debating will be maybe still there come March. But as we saw in 16, the Bernie and Hillary primary was a big deal in Ohio. It was a big deal in 08 as well between Obama and Hillary Clinton. So I actually think, you know, you're going to have some winnowing down of the field. But I think all of a sudden, and the Republicans moved it back 1 week, so now it happens to be on St. Patrick's Day, which is going to be odd. But I think there will be a week or two where all of a sudden those remaining in the race, Ohio will all of a sudden be a major prize because it's a lot of delegates, but it's also this symbolic state that if you can win Ohio, you can win the country. So I actually think that, of course, they're all thinking about Iowa, New Hampshire every moment, and South Carolina and Nevada. But I also think the ones who know they're in it for a little bit of a longer haul know that this primary matters to them in March. And our hope is that all, and I think by being in Westerville, which is one, you know, being in Otterbein, being in Westerville, this is a suburb of Franklin County that only a few years ago was Republican, and now it's Democrat. And so the other thing, and this is a secondary effect, is, as the professor said, the first thing is winning the primary. But our hope is that this next year, one reason I think Ohio can be blue is because this major shift happening with women voters, particularly in the suburbs, is changing the math. And our hope is that as these new sort of swing voters look at our debate versus what they're seeing at Donald Trump, this is sort of an opportunity for them to sort of hopefully continue to move comfortably in our direction versus where they used to vote. So I hope it has some of that effect, although I agree the first and most important audience to these candidates are the voters. One thing I want to say, though, and I think Yvette will agree with this, after 16, the Democratic Party worked very hard to reform ourselves. So the old system where superdelegates lined up in advance and announced who they're voting for, that's gone. And I do think – my hope is – and I was a big champion, as I'm sure Yvette was and others. That needed to change. So this impression that was only about party insiders, which was – you know, couldn't have been reflected more clearly by that superdelegate process. We got rid of that process, so it really does come more to the voters of Iowa, New Hampshire versus a bunch of people announcing in advance who they support. That won't be happening this time.
Yvette, is it a bit unfair the way that just the primary calendar works? And it's true for both parties, right? I mean, should it rotate a little bit? Shouldn't some states that don't traditionally get the opportunity to go first have the opportunity to go first?
That would be awesome. How do we make that happen? I mean, I think, you know, this is the way it's been done. I think politics is like glacial slow for change, although California moved up. So yeah, we've seen some shift in the calendar. calendar. I would say that Iowa voters are not in a tunnel, though. And so everything that happens between now and that caucus is going to affect those voters on the ground, right? So we heard the news about what happened with Senator Sanders today. We heard about the energy that Liz Warren has had. We know that this thing has shifted with Biden over the last couple debates. Everything that happens at every debate with every candidate between now and Iowa is going to affect those voters. And as David said, we expect the field to be narrowed, particularly because of the rules, the DNC rules around the debate. We don't know who's going to be even at the table in November, because now you've got to get a higher threshold for polling, which has been really challenging, honestly, for a lot of these candidates. So I also think that Iowa, even though it's very different from Ohio, is one of the early states that reflects the middle America nature of Ohio. So that part of Ohio that feels very, you know, authentic, the part that represents rural voters, the part that represents some of the progressives that live in Ohio, too. So I wouldn't say that Iowa isn't a bellwether for Ohio, because when you compare, for instance, Ohio to California, Iowa looks more like Ohio than California looks like Ohio. So for the early primary states, I think Iowa looks a little bit more like Ohio than really any of them. I'm excited about South Carolina. I think South Carolina, because of the fact that you've got a very diverse slate of candidates, because black and brown voters are going to be so important in this election, I would argue are important in every election, but especially in this election, I don't know that we know who really the front runner is going to be of the candidates until we get to South Carolina.
African-American voters are always key on the Democratic side of things. They're really credited for giving Alabama Senator Doug Jones the opportunity to represent that state as a Democrat in the United States Senate.
And we may get to run that race again.
That's right. That could be coming up as
another
well.
Another conversation.
Well, of course. But when you talk about Iowa, you do have mostly white people, and the race looks different according to polling of the Democratic primary. That's true in New Hampshire as well.
Absolutely.
In South Carolina, former Vice President Joe Biden has a big lead, and a lot of that is based on his support from African American voters.
Right. And that can shift.
Yeah,
because,
of
course, you know,
Hillary Clinton
was winning.
That's right.
Was winning South Carolina until Barack Obama won Iowa.
And a lot of the analysis of that race indicates that Iowa and New Hampshire gave voters in South Carolina, even though New Hampshire went for Hillary Clinton that year, but it gave those voters the opportunity to think that Barack Obama was a viable candidate.
Right. It takes African American vote. Like, we can love you. We can love you a lot, and we do. But we need to know you can win before we shift our support. And so we'll see. And you know, you talk about Kamala Harris. We don't talk about her a whole lot. She seems pretty far behind the field. But Hillary Clinton was 21 points ahead of Obama at this point in the race. So a lot can shift between now and Iowa.
I want to bring Sarah back in here, mainly because we've had you on before, Sarah, to talk about your book with your co-author. I think you're wrong, but I'm listening. And there's not a whole lot of that goes on in our discourse these days, just listening to one another. I'm wondering what you're seeing from that perspective as we see the United States House of Representatives move forward on an impeachment inquiry, which can be politically divisive, and putting that on top of just the general divisiveness we've been living through for the past several years. How do you think that translates into Ohio specifically?
Well, I think we see an exhaustion from both sides with the current political climate. And you don't need to be a rocket scientist to figure out that impeachment is going to add to that exhaustion, particularly an impeachment that is taking place during a presidential election, which we've never seen in our country's history. And so what I would encourage everyone, whether you live in an important state like Ohio or in a state that gets no presidential play, the important thing we always say is that you have to prioritize the relationship with which it was in the person you're speaking with instead of prioritizing winning the political points. And, you know, I think that that's going to be especially important with us, all Americans, as we move forward into this incredibly sort of historic moment. This is a long game when we're talking about the future of our democracy, when we're debating politics, when we're looking at a presidential election, where with Beth, that we don't want to leave a we're not required to leave any political conversation with draft legislation. So taking that sort of long perspective to say, yeah, we're facing some really big things and it's not going to be fixed in one conversation. So let's prioritize the way to move out of the conversation in a positive way, to keep the relationship intact, and to keep sort of all conversations about politics in their place even when we're facing impeachment and presidential politics.
Rachel, Sarah raises a good point that we've not had an impeachment. We've had impeachments before, certainly, but not during an election cycle, really, for the president. How do you think this plays out in this campaign? We've seen some caution from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi originally in her approach to this, but now it looks like it's moving forward with some new issues having arisen. What happens?
So I won't normally say this, but I don't think history is very helpful here. We have an N of four, and I'm not sure Andrew Johnson really holds some lessons right now, if you see what I'm saying. So this is a little bit unusual. Something that makes it even more unusual is the way public opinion has rapidly shifted. So the public is not only aware of this, but they're increasingly in support not only of the inquiry, but possibly of an impeachment. And it doesn't help that Trump's approval ratings are very low for someone entering a reelection. So you couple that with the fact that Democratic voters increasingly say that the most important issue to them, if we can consider this an issue, is someone's ability to defeat Trump. I don't necessarily see the impeachment as an irrelevant topic here, or even as one that's too wonkish. Voters seem to be able to understand the idea of treason or bringing other countries into our elections a little bit better than the drawn-out Russia investigation. And beyond that, the Democratic field seems pretty united in support of impeachment. So I don't see it as being a limiting factor. What I think we should probably consider is what happens between now and the general election. So depending how the impeachment goes, we could have President Trump who's emerge from that unscathed. We could have a president who's still in hearings. We could have Mike Pence as the president. And these are all different scenarios that we probably need to consider a little bit more.
And David, I want to talk about party establishment in this context, because during the Russia investigation, political polling of the public's opinion on impeachment was not favorable towards impeachment by a wide margin. But as Dr. Bloom just said, that has tightened up considerably with, I think, the most recent poll I showed, knotted up at 47 apiece in favor of impeachment and removal,
right,
by the way. So what do you think has shifted the public's opinion in this matter so quickly? Let me add a second question to that as well, so that you can answer in the context of our purpose here today. How do the Democrats use it?
So the first question, I think that, as the professor pointed out, I mean, one, I think that this is much more easy to understand, not drawn out. It's about interfering in an election that's coming as opposed to relitigating one that happened, which I think also maybe felt less important to voters. I also think leadership matters. And, you know, Barack Obama, the polling on the same-sex marriage, the minute Obama came out for it, it flipped incredibly quickly. And I think in this case, we've all watched Speaker Pelosi be very hesitant. No one can say she looked eager to do this. So I think if you've watched her for the last year, and then all of a sudden she says, oh my gosh, this is so much worse than anything else, even though I've been hesitant, I'm willing to move forward. I think a whole lot of voters who also had heard her hesitancy thought, well, if after she's been hesitant, she's moving forward and not kidding around about it, I think people follow that. And I think I don't think she did it for political reasons, but I think holding back turns out to have been a very smart move, because it doesn't look like she was eager to do this. You know, I don't know how it plays out, and I respect that at some point, at some moments, I wish it was more often, people got to put politics aside. And if you believe, as I think they do, that this is an egregious violation and that the Constitution is being torn apart by, once you start calling in foreign powers, it goes to the pit, the heart of what founders were concerned about hundreds of years ago, that I think you know, if it builds into a narrative that Trump is already sort of imploding and violating all sorts of norms, perhaps it helps, maybe it hurts. But at some point, I think this is where the speaker is, you just got to move forward because it's the right thing to do. So I think it's hard to predict how it'll play out, but I support what they're doing, because I think especially people said to me, I was in a class the other day, well, why didn't you just let the election play out and see what the voters think? If part of the violation is that they're trying to interfere with that election, you can't just sit back and say, let's see how the election turns out. That's the whole point here. And I think really doing what they're doing has been incredibly important to finally holding some accountability.
Okay, I've got just a little bit of time left. I want to make sure I get one more question into Yvette, and then I'm going to open up to all of you for just a few seconds each to give some I guess, perspective on what might happen to Ohio next year. But Yvette, you identified yourself as sort of representing the progressive side of the Democratic Party. You heard David describe Nancy Pelosi's caution there. Nancy Pelosi had been criticized pretty heavily by some members of the progressive side of things. I subscribe to The New Yorker. They came out with a story this week that described her as a very stable genius, famously flipping the script on a way that President Trump had described himself. What are your thoughts as a progressive representative of the Democratic Party on Nancy Pelosi's handling of this?
You know, if you had asked me a couple months ago, I would have said what we had said publicly, that she was waiting too long, right? The closer we get to the election, the harder this thing is to do. And, you know, our organization has been in support of impeachment since 2017. We also need to give credit to the progressive members who were out front, Maxine Waters, Rashida Tlaib, the squad, who were on top of this from the very beginning and were convinced with the Russia investigation that there had been impeachable offenses that should have been investigated. I will say that Nancy Pelosi's job is to bring the caucus together. And she finally felt like she had something where we could all be on the same page. I also think this is a little different because, one, you've got an admission by the president. You've got an admission by his personal lawyer. You've also got a transcript. And it was his action. It wasn't a member of his campaign. It wasn't a member of his administration. He actually made this call. I also think the aftermath has been really helpful, right? So Pompeo now is admitting that he lied to Congress when he said he wasn't on the call when he was on the call. You've got Australia that has now been brought as part of this. You got Rudy Giuliani is helping us on TV every single day with his text messages. I think this thing is going to really resolve itself. And I think Nancy Pelosi is doing a good job. And I would, and this is a conversation we're having on the progressive flank, continuing to remind the leadership to be strong here. If you got to arrest people for violating subpoenas or for not answering questions, if you got to hold people to contempt, do it.
All right, last question for everyone, 10 to 15 seconds or so each. Sarah, we'll start with you since you've waited patiently on the phone line with us. Is Ohio still a bellwether state? And in 2020, who wins Ohio, President Trump or the Democratic candidate?
Oh, goodness. I think with the historical facts that we're facing right now, it's really hard to predict. I think because of how we started this conversation, that the big issues are essential to Ohioans, the health insurance, income inequality. I think it will still be a very important state. And because of those same issues, and because I'm an eternal optimist, I think the Democratic nominee will win in 2020.
All right, Sarah, thanks. Yvette, we'll go to you.
I think Ohio is definitely a bellwether, an important state. I don't know. I think it depends on what we do, right? He won Ohio by 8 points. That's not
President Trump.
And he's been here, like we were talking about earlier, every week. So I think it depends on what we do. I think if David, you know, does a great job, if I do a great job, if the party does a great job in bringing voters out, we can definitely win.
David?
Thank you. So Donald Trump has been to Ohio more than any other state except where he owns golf clubs. And there's a reason for that. He knows he's underwater here. He's underwater because the suburbs are shifting blue. The former base of the Republican Party is now turning Democrat. And he's crushing soybean farms and he's crushing manufacturing auto jobs. That goes right to the heart of the Ohio economy. He's here because he's underwater. If we get the right candidate, run the right campaign, we can do two things next November. One, end the Trump presidency right here in Ohio. Two, end gerrymandering as well. So it's a huge election for us with huge stakes. And the reason the DNC debate is here is because they also understand that Ohio can end the Trump presidency by being blue.
And Rachel, you're our political science guest joining our Democrats today. Very quickly, what happens in Ohio next year, and is it still a bellwether?
It could be. As a rule, Republicans vote more, especially old, white, wealthy Republicans. If the Democratic Party can mobilize their base and maybe persuade some swing voters, it could be.
Our thanks to Democratic Party Chairman David Pepper, podcaster and author Sarah Stewart Holland, and of course, Yvette Simpson, our former local city councilwoman, now chief executive of Democracy for Action. You can hear her later this afternoon on NPR's Here and Now. Thank you for being here as well. And Miami University political science professor Dr. Rachel Bloom, thanks for being here as well.
Thank you.
The Republican panel is up next. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Our conversation about Ohio's bellwether status and its role in the 2020 presidential election continues now with our Republican panel. We're joined on the phone by Ohio Republican Party Chairwoman Jane Timken. Jane, thanks for joining us. Okay, well
oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
Apologies, Jane. Glad you could be here with us. Thanks for joining us. We also have on the phone former Kentucky Secretary of State and my fellow Northern Kentuckian, Trey Grayson. Trey, thanks for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
And the political science professor joining the Republican panel today is University of Cincinnati Assistant Professor of Political Science, Dr. Andrew Lewis. Dr. Lewis, thanks for being here as well in the studio.
Thank you, Michael. Glad to be here.
And again, listeners, because of the number of guests that we have joining us today, we can't take phone calls, but feel free to shoot us an email at talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets as always. So let's start with you, Jane. I'm so glad you could be with us today. Your colleague on the Democratic side, David Pepper, was with us in the first half. We're about 2 weeks away from another Democratic presidential primary debate. It'll be held at Otterbein. I'm wondering if you, as leader of the Republican Party here in the state, would be looking for certain positions from those Democrats that you would seek to amplify to get voters to pay attention to for the benefit of the Republican candidate.
Well, sure. I think if you look at the policy positions of the majority of their candidates, and in fact, the candidates who are at the top of their polling with voters in the Democrat primaries, are those policies that are of the avowed socialist Bernie Sanders. They are advocating openly for increasing taxes, taking over Medicare for All, which, quite frankly, would destroy our health care for many Americans, including those union members who have a private health care system. They talk constantly about the Green New Deal, which, again, the AFL-CIO has come out and said that would be a job-killing proposal. They're really talking about eliminating cars and planes, any type of carbon in this country, which is a large part of our manufacturing base. I think it's incredibly unrealistic, all of their policies, and quite frankly, would fundamentally change the lives of many Americans, and those are the policies that we would amplify.
And I'm also wondering, Jane, how the Republican Party amplifies the political differences there. You did highlight some of the issues there, but we've got sort of an internal debate that we're seeing within the Democratic Party from the progressive wing and maybe the more moderate centrist wing. Is there something that, I guess I'm just wondering strategically how you prepare to counter either of those that may emerge as the victor on that side?
Well, I think from what I can tell, it's really the progressives that are taking control over the Democrat Party. They're the ones that are in the lead in the polls. You see Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren talking about, quite frankly, outlandish policy decisions. Free college, free housing. Those are counter to a lot of those hardworking Americans in their own beliefs. America was founded on people who really believed in working hard, getting a job, putting food on the table for their families. They don't want a handout. They want to be able to work hard for their families and have a good, decent life. And their policies are left coast and east coast policies, and they don't resonate with Ohioans. And we will make sure that Ohioans understand how they will fundamentally change their lives if the Democrats succeed.
Trey Grayson, let's bring you in, the former Kentucky Secretary of State and a really longtime student of politics. And I know you've been observing the Democratic side as well. What do you think Ohio voters will be looking for from these candidates? And how will Republicans use this type of debate to their advantage?
Yeah, one of the things that happens when you get into a presidential race, especially once there's a nominee for each party, and obviously there'll be third-party candidates on the ballot, but it kind of becomes a binary choice. So you've got a head-to-head race, and what it does is it causes some people who maybe are members of a party or lean towards a party to stick with the party's candidate, even if that's not their preferred choice, because they look at the other side and say, well, I can't be for that. Ohio has been an interesting state because it's been sort of the ultimate bellwether, in part because of its size, in part because it's this interesting mixture of urban, rural, suburban, doesn't have, African-American pockets in the urban core, growing suburbs. And so basically, as Ohio went, the country went. I think going back to 1960, maybe even longer, Ohio always picked the winner. One thing that we saw in 16 was the margin wasn't as close in Ohio as it was in some of the other battleground Midwestern states. So one thing that appears to me that's happening in Ohio is Ohio's become probably a little bit more Republican. Doesn't mean a Republican will lose, will automatically win, that Trump will automatically win, but it's become a little bit more Republican. They're winning more statewide races year after year after year. So it's a little bit more of an uphill push for the Democrats. It's also not quite as important, maybe, as some of the other Midwestern states. Not surprising that the president's been there more than almost any other state. But it'll be fascinating to watch once the party has to come together. I think the other challenge that Democrats will have in Ohio is a divisive primary that'll probably go for a little bit of time. But even if it's a quick primary, let's say somebody sweeps the early states and wraps up the nomination early, Trump and the Republicans, Jane has been able to continue to organize since the last election, Republican Party troops. They had a governor's race. I remember in 2012, a bunch of Kentuckians had came over to Ohio to help organize for Romney and running into Obama organizers who had not stopped since 2008. And that four-year head start, because some of my friends were working over there, they said, was tough to overcome. You know, they knew they had their organization in place and they knew their voters. And when you're the party out of power in a state the size of Ohio, that's a challenge. That's just a legitimate challenge. And on the margin, you know, that's worth a half point or a point. And in a close election, that's the difference between winning and losing.
Andrew Lewis is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Cincinnati. He's here in the studio with me. You heard Trey there reference that President Trump won Ohio last year, last time around in 2016 by 8 points, which was the largest margin of victory by a winner of a presidential election since George H.W. Bush had won by about 11 points back in 1988. I'm wondering, now that we've seen President Trump in action and we've seen some of his policies implemented, what Ohio voters are looking for from him and from these Democratic candidates now?
Yeah, I think it's probably a pretty accurate picture to say that Ohio's status is moving more toward the Republican Party and that perhaps it's not even as much of a toss-up state as it has been in years past. And a lot of the trends, both the political and some of the demographic political shifts, seem to be pointing in that direction. But that doesn't mean – I think when a president's in office, you get a softening of approval often. President Trump's approval has been fairly steady, but I would guess as the campaign the 2020 campaign ramps up, you'll get sort of Republicans sort of uniting behind it a bit, the sort of classic partisan move. So what are they going to be looking for the Democratic debate? I mean, I think essentially most people aren't watching and paying too close of attention, but we will start seeing elites paint different candidates and perhaps the whole party with the language of certain candidates. And that will be used in part to mobilize, as Trey, I think, was mentioning, sort of the other side. The other side is a bad choice. This is our choice. And so I think you'll see a lot of sort of our team, their team sort of movement going on. And that's what I expect.
We're joined on the phone by Ohio Republican Party Chairwoman Jane Temkin. And Jane, I don't want to spend a lot of time rehashing the 2016 race because we're looking ahead now to what may go down in the 2020 race. But President Trump did carry Ohio by 8 points in 2016 over Hillary Clinton, and he's probably looking to keep the Buckeye State in his column next time around. So first, I'm wondering how President Trump was able to carry Ohio by as many points as he did last time, and what his winning message might be this time around.
Well, sure. And I think it's significant when you talk about Ohio being a bellwether state. What was significant in 2016 was the number of counties that flipped from blue counties to red counties. We had over 8 states that flipped, and these were traditional Democrat stronghold counties like Ashtabula, Erie, Sandusky, even Montgomery County in Dayton, you know, where Dayton is. And we're starting to see those trends. We saw them in 2018 where we picked up a Senate seat in the Mahoning Valley and it hadn't been held by a Republican senator in decades. So we're seeing some movement towards the Republican Party, I think in large part because Ohio voters reward good leadership. And we've seen good leadership in Ohio under the Republican Party and Governor DeWine. I think when they were looking at President Trump, he was talking about things that resonated with those voters. And he's delivered on those promises. He was talking about jobs, lower taxes, the border security, taking care of our veterans. You think about all the accomplishments. He's the first president that actually moved the embassy to Jerusalem. All of those promises made and promises kept are what is going to keep the Ohio voters voting for President Trump and will return him for re-election in 2020.
Andrew, in the previous panel with the Democrats, we talked about the role that African-American voters play as a base for those candidates. On the Republican side, evangelicals play a very big role. What kind of role are they going to play this time around, do you think, in Ohio?
Well, I would say that they're evangelicals have become perhaps the central core of the Republican Party. This is sort of the white evangelicals, the central base of that party. I would expect that to continue. Their support for President Trump and Republicans in general has been quite firm and strong. And so I would guess that they will remain a strong part of that. I mean, I think in some sense we can think of them, they are distinctive in some ways, but they're just classic stronghold of the Republican Party in many ways, okay? And so I would expect them to turn out, to be mobilized, and to continue to sort of push Republican candidates in 2020. All of this is to say, like, there's possible we get some changes based on investigations and impeachment hearings, but I would strongly suggest that stability on that side is where we're going.
Trey Grayson, as the former Kentucky Secretary of State, you ran for that office twice, and you had to certainly appeal to evangelical voters in Kentucky for statewide races, so you know what this is like. But I'm wondering, just from your academic perspective, how you think President Trump, with all that we've known about him as sort of a media character that seems to run in contrast of what you would expect evangelicals to support, how has he managed to keep that group of voters in his side?
So I think there's probably a couple things he has working for him. One is he was a known commodity. I think especially for people who I have to confess, I never really watched The Apprentice, but The Apprentice had really high ratings. The Apprentice submitted his brand, whether it was accurate or not, it doesn't matter because perception is reality a lot of the times in politics. So he had a unique brand, and people kind of knew he was, you know, he had multiple marriages and multiple affairs, and So when things came out, they weren't as much of a surprise. People kind of knew what they were getting, and it's easier to overcome. So that brand and sort of it's just part of Donald Trump. But the second thing is, and Jane mentioned one of the issues about moving the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which was a promise that I believe most presidential candidates had made if they become the party's nominees, and nobody had ever done it. President Trump did it. He also has remade the judiciary with a real focus with Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, of making sure that the limited amount of time the Senate is in session, that a disproportionate number, you might say, is going to be spent on kind of confirmations. And so the Court of Appeals and the district courts in America are totally different, and they're the kinds of justices that evangelical voters really would like. They're much more focused on limited government, protecting religious freedom, probably more open to restrictions on abortion. We haven't necessarily seen these decisions come up through the ranks of the courts, but we know that these are lifetime appointments, and that's a record of accomplishment. The president, when he ran on it, probably played a big role in encouraging evangelicals to stick with him despite concerns they may have had about him as a person, and that his track record there has been pretty helpful. I think the third thing, in his last race, he was running against Hillary Clinton, and the Clintons and Hillary were not somebody that were very appealing to evangelicals. And I mentioned earlier, when there's a binary choice, if you're an evangelical voter in 2016, you're looking at Hillary Clinton, husband of Bill Clinton, versus Donald Trump, who promises to appoint a bunch of judges to you support. That, I think, brought a lot of votes in his way. And he's delivered on a lot of the promises that he's made. So it's a little bit of a jarring disconnect with his personal life and having evangelicals be a strong part of his base. But if you look at the record, it does make some level of sense.
The U.S. House is moving forward with its impeachment inquiry, Jane, and we are seeing polls that suggest more Americans are supportive of that effort compared to several months ago when they were polled on the same question. But it also appears to have rallied voters behind the president as well. He's had a massive haul of cash being raised amid the announcement of this impeachment inquiry. But I'm wondering, Jane, if there is concern at all on the Republican side about the impact this impeachment inquiry could have.
Well, I think it's galvanizing Republican voters and even some of those voters, those non-traditional voters who voted for the president. They are always been strong supporters of the president, but when they see what the Democrats are doing, look, I'll be frank, the Democrats have tried to take this president down since the day he was elected. They are trying to overturn a duly elected president. And when you look at the history of what they've been talking about since, quite frankly, November of 2016, they've been talking about trying to take this president out. Every other week, it's an impeachment proposal. Look back on it. Just a few weeks ago, they were trying to promote an impeachment of Justice Kavanaugh. This is their playbook now. They know they can't win, so they want to take this president down now. Because their candidates, I think they've recognized that they don't have winning candidates, and this is their best option. I think it's really going to divide the country, but I think it's more than anything galvanized Republican voters behind this president. They see what's going on. They don't like it. I live in Ohio. I talk to Ohioans and not just Republicans. They take a look at what they're saying that the president should be impeached over, and they don't get it. They don't understand why the Democrats are doing this. And I don't get it either. I don't understand. I think it's a mistake for them to do it. I think when you look at history, it's going to come back to bite them. And I think that you look at the small dollar donations that have surged for the president, and those are people who voted for him likely for the first time, and they're staying with this president.
Okay, let me give 30 seconds to Trey and Andrew on this before we move into our final question of this panel. Trey, quickly, what are your thoughts on how concerned the president and the Republicans should be about this inquiry?
Well, I think there is some level of concern, especially when you look at some of the movement in the polls over the weekend that seemed to show a little bit more Republicans than I would have expected, at least being open to this inquiry and curious how it's going to play out. And if there's something there, having a chamber of Congress look at these issues, there could be something there. And so I think you need to have some level of concern. The flip side of that, it is, and you only give me 30 seconds, so I'm not going to go too deep into this, but it's also very risky for the Democrats because if he destabilizes, it allows Trump to really, rally his base around him. And if there's not something you could have a very hard time winning over, enough Americans to warrant removal, and then maybe it's risking getting the Democrats off message. And they look more desperate and partisan and political as opposed to statesmanlike, which is where they want to be.
Andrew, your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I think there probably is going to be some concern, in large part because of the movement on the independent side. I mean, there's some movement on Republicans, but the real sharp movement is that independents have become more supportive of these sort of impeachment inquiries. And I think that is a concern for someone who's trying to win a national election and recruit independents and sort of more conservative-leaning Democrats. So I think there's going to be some concern. It's very early in the cycle to see sort of how this is going to play out. But if there are months of hearings and investigation releases, this could be problematic, but it's probably too early to tell which side it'll come down on.
All right. Our last question for everyone is Ohio still a bellwether? And in 2020, who wins it? Jane Timken, we'll start with you.
Well, Ohio is still a bellwether. We're going to fight for every vote that we're never going to let up. We were successful in 2016 and 2018 because we have a great turnout and get out the vote infrastructure. The Trump campaign is very active in Ohio, has been on the ground. We have field organizers and voter registration drives going on, voter contacts. We're ready for 2020, and President Trump's going to win Ohio and win re-election.
Trey?
Based on what I know today, and given the trends of Ohio becoming redder, I'm still going to predict that Ohio goes for Trump. But there's just so much uncertainty in the air, who the nominee is, impeachment inquiry, and all that, that I hope you'll have me on later.
We'll definitely.
November, and I can make a more informed prediction.
We'll definitely have you back. And Andrew, in our last 10 seconds, your thoughts on that as well.
I would say it's probably a second-tier bellwether, and today it probably leans to Republicans and President Trump, but these things could change.
My big thanks to Ohio Republican Party Chairwoman Jane Timken, former Kentucky Secretary of State Trey Grayson, and University of Cincinnati Political Science Professor Dr. Andrew Lewis. Thanks to all of you for being with us today. And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.